Hey, welcome inside the MTOM podcast room here at Iowa PBS. I'm Paul Yeager, and in this installment of the podcast this week, we're going to get down and dirty with water. It's a topic that is important from coast to coast, including the I states. We're going to talk about water in Boston and California and in Iowa with John Norwood. He is on the Polk County Water Conservation Board. And we're going to discuss about how a guy who grew up in Boston ended up in Iowa, but what he's learned from his stops along the way and his curiosity. And he's going to have some thoughts about land and land usage, soil and soil usage. That is this installment of the podcast. If you have any ideas for me, paul.yeager@iowapbs.org or feedback, send it your way, guest idea, or you just want to tell me what you had for breakfast, I'd like to hear that too. Here's today's installment of the MTOM Show podcast. Okay, is this Boston-New York rivalry in sports, is that real?
It is real. Yeah. Why? It's deep.
I just always think it gets to be made out a little too much by the network with four letters. It does a lot of sports. But I've been in both stadiums, and if you wear the wrong hat at the wrong time, you get a little extra discussion points.
We do. And the memories run deep. And it all started, I think, with Babe Ruth, when the Yankees ripped off Babe Ruth.
Okay, so that answer right there tells me you do have allegiance to the hometown
team. Yeah, so I follow all the teams, and in fact, going out to with my son to see the New England Patriots play in Indianapolis on the 17th. So we will do a road trip for that shortly.
Well, just a couple of days before we recorded this, Bill Belichick took his team up to Buffalo.
Right,
they threw the ball three times.
Right, yeah,
you know, in those windy conditions.
That's right,
weather conditions. Crazy. He just keeps winning.
Vintage Belichick and Brady. I'm a big Brady fan, too.
Oh, he's done well.
Even in Tampa Bay.
That's good for you to admit. That's above you.
Yeah.
So you grew up in the city or outside of Boston?
I grew up in a western suburb, a town called Wayland, about 10 minutes from Concord. The shot heard around the world, the farmer shot, start the Revolutionary War. So history has always been a love of mine. And a little detail about my hometown. It was founded as part of Sudbury Plantation in 1638. So farming goes way back in the town of Wayland.
Did you have any farm roots?
My farm roots were the garden. My mother was a big gardener. She helped establish a community garden in the town where the community came together in the summers. And so I have a lot of experience with vegetables. And I even had an interest in my early teens of growing fruit trees. I wanted to see if I could do that. And so I established in the backyard some apples and pears and even some peaches, which in New England is a bit of a feat. But there are some varieties of peach that will grow in our New England winter.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yep. So then, did you want to stay around there, or what took you?
So I've lived on both coasts and here in Iowa since 2002. And on the East Coast, I went to school in Western Massachusetts, a small college called Williams College, where our mascot is a purple cow, believe it or not. And, you know, one of the things you remember, these odd little details from life. So I was a history major. And in my junior year, I wrote a term paper on Henry Wallace and his efforts back in the under the Roosevelt administration. And that was a foreshadowing of my life. I had no idea that someday I would find myself in Iowa.
Did you have any? How did you pick Wallace?
You know, I don't know. It was just agriculture was something that was of interest to me. It was a passion, and so I pursued that in part at Williams, and I graduated, and then I went off to work at Boston for about 3 years, which included 2 years working for something called the Massachusetts Water Resources Authority, which is the oldest and one of the largest municipal suppliers in the country. So I worked with the capital engineers, the guys that like to build things. And so we worked on the water side. Mm-hmm. There's also the wastewater side, which was fascinating. I had done a term paper also in college on the cleanup of Boston Harbor. It was terribly polluted at the time. And it's now a success story. And so Boston, in the Boston area, the 3.5 million people and the 60 plus communities that serve by this water agency. Fascinating in terms of the from the aqueducts or from the watersheds reservoirs through the aqueducts into the Boston area.
Now that brings up, we're going to get there about rural urban.
Yeah.
But what was Boston Harbor's biggest problem? Was it the rural issue? Was it the urban issue?
Well, the cleanup of the Boston Harbor was the result of political gridlock for about 100 years. If you look at the history of Boston, both in the water supply and the wastewater supply, there tends to be a lot of activity every 50 to 100 years. And, you know, you get to the point where, oh, we got to do something, and then people forget about it. And so Boston had a primary treatment system that was horribly lots of deferred maintenance in it, and it wasn't designed particularly well. The engineers thought that let's put the outfall for the sewage at the narrow point of Boston Harbor, with the idea that on the outgoing tide that the sewage would be carried out to Boston into Massachusetts Bay. The problem is tides go both ways, as you can imagine. So that was part of the problem. Another problem was the fact that the both the storm water and the sanitary sewers were not separated. They were combined. And so during big storm events, the system would get overloaded, and basically all the excess wastewater would end up in Boston Harbor. So it had all sorts of flotations, and I think it was the Shondells, Love That Dirty Water.
That's about Boston Harbor?
Charles River.
Oh, about Charles River.
Which flows right into Boston Harbor. So there's an incredible success story. It was billions of dollars both on the wastewater side. The water side was more of a story about deferred maintenance on the transmission system, and so it had a series of aqueducts, for example, that were really sort of held together by Band-Aids and bubblegum. And so that needed to be updated.
Well, and that's very good knowledge that you have on your term paper.
Yes,
you know, just on the research, I'm pulling you back 25, 30 years. So
yeah, it's still in there.
I want to get back to Boston in a minute because that's fascinating to me. Took you to California. What'd you do out there?
Yeah, well, there was a stop at the Yale Forestry School and the Yale School of Management after Boston. And I had a passion, I mentioned, for water. And Yale Forestry School has an incredible history, too, with some Iowa connections. Aldo Leopold was one of the first graduates of the Yale Forestry School, which was founded by Gifford Pinchot. He was a Yale undergrad, and he got through. He was interested in botany and forestry, and after he graduated from Yale, he saw that there wasn't any schooling for forestry, so he had to go to Europe and then eventually came back and convinced the trustees to start a forestry school. I'm not sure exactly how you do that, but he was successful, and then he went off and he eventually created the U.S. Forest Service under the auspices of Teddy Roosevelt. He became friends with Teddy and was Teddy's right-hand man in terms of conservation. So a lot of these people, it's really a small group of people when you look back through history and that sort of collision of different ideas. I came out of the forestry school. What I learned from the forestry school and the school of management is people are very tribal. And so you had these two schools. You had, you know, the penny loafers, I like to refer to them, at the school of management, and then the Birkenstock people in the school of forestry. And those two groups, there are a few that would go back and forth and take classes and so forth. And I was one of about six that had a joint degree. So I went back and forth, and you were often considered to be the other person by both sides. And so that was part of my DNA and in my learning that, you know, sometimes if you want to be a leader, you have to think differently, and you have to be willing to hang out with people who might think differently from you. And that has carried through in my career. I went to the West Coast. My former wife, who's a professor at Drake, got an opportunity to go to Stanford. She's a PhD in English, and so we spent about 10 years orbiting the Bay Area. I worked with some of the largest Fortune 500 companies in financial matters and so forth, and I had a chance to work with the Resources Secretary of the State of California, a guy by the name of Doug Wheeler, who is Pete Wilson's two-term officer in that position. That office is like the combination of our DNR and our Department of Agriculture, and of course, California is the only state in the country that beats Iowa in terms of its GDP related to agriculture.
Well, so I believe it's the fifth largest country in economy.
And
then, you know, agriculture is still a, is still a part of that.
Yeah.
It's amazing that it's actually smaller. I mean, it's huge, but in the overall scheme, it just shows how big the economy in California
is.
So I'm always curious about those who spend time in the East and the West, both about people, but the way of doing things. But water, I mean, is the water treated differently? I guess treated is the, not a proper word to use because that means something different. Wastewater, but thought of differently, East versus West. Because in the West, all we hear about in agriculture is we need that to water crops, to to make sure that food can continue to be cared for. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think, it, well, particularly in the West, you go beyond the 100th meridian and water scarcity is an issue. And even California has a history of water wars and so forth. You can go watch the movie Chinatown, and you can see the history of California, particularly Southern California, fighting for access to water. And, of course, they draw from the Colorado River. That's a resource that's been stressed. And California has a unique relationship with the federal government in terms of water and the water that starts and captured in the Sierra, and then it finds its way down into the Central Valley, and then some of it through the Delta. And so that's been very contentious, and over the years. And Mark Twain's famous words about whiskeys for drinking and waters for fighting, I think he had California in mind.
We've said that a time or two on Market to Market.
Sure.
We have an old boss that really liked to write that one. And water is important.
Yes.
So then you get to Iowa.
Yes.
I'm guessing career is through Drake and Des Moines. But how did you get involved with water in central Iowa, in Polk County specifically?
So, you know, my history goes back. I've been interested and worked in business transformation for many years through a number of different iterations. TBL Ventures is my consulting and investing organization. TBL stands for the triple bottom line: people, planet, profits. And I get excited when I'm working with businesses and organizations on issues having to do with transformation. How do we get from where we are today? Where is it where we want to go tomorrow? And what's the best way to get there? And so I've had the opportunity to work on a lot of very interesting agricultural aspects of our agricultural economy over those years, beginning with the rise of the ethanol plants. What people don't often understand about ethanol is the ethanol plants produce something else besides ethanol, because the corn kernel has three parts. It's got carbohydrate, protein, and a fat. And so we take that carbohydrate, we turn that into ethanol. The backside, the back end, the back door of the ethanol plant, then we have the protein and the fat. And so there was quite a challenge for a period of time. What do we do with the DDGs, right?
Well, and the DDG at some parts of the discussion is actually more valuable than the ethanol.
That's right.
Specifically in the middle of 2020, in the pandemic, when nobody was buying, nobody was driving, there was no fuel.
Right.
But the DDG was still needed.
Yeah. And so, you know, one of the early challenges for the ethanol plants was to figure out what do we do with the DDGs? What are the standards for the DDGs? How much fat do we want? What's the fat content we want? What's the protein content? How much of this stuff can we feed? What can we feed it to before the pig blows up? We had something called soft pork that was a problem for a while, and you know, you had a lot of very smart people, the PhD scientists up at Iowa State and K-State and other places, scratching their heads. And so I was working on some aspects of some of the specialty feeds and what we could do with some of those things, some of the oils, for example. I also worked with a co-op up in north central Iowa. This was sort of an interesting Max Shield co-op. And they had an idea for managing manure that I worked on with them with. And the idea was basically we have all this manure and we expect all the hog operators to be, you know, the idea is maybe they can all be wastewater treatment operators if we want to add value to that stream. And we came at it and said, well, let's not make everybody try to be a wastewater treatment operator. They already have many things to do. It's already hard enough. And so we looked at the idea of a community-based digesting system. And, you know, we talk an hour about what we learned through that experience. And I'm still hopeful that I think with climate change and focus on carbon dioxide and methane in particular. We produce a third of the nation's pork, 50 million animals. There's a lot of manure out there, and the potential to add value to that manure through anaerobic digestion, and all sorts of wonderful things start happening. You kill the pathogens, you control odor, you can dewater and so forth, and you can create a more stable, nutrient, consistent product. So there's a lot of opportunity, certainly lots of challenges, but that was another example of what I did. The water part, you know, to me, as I spent my time in Iowa, and I kind of got frustrated with the fact, the lack of progress and the name calling and so forth. And as a systems person, systems thinker, I'm thinking, okay, this is really big system, 23 million acres, number two in output only to California. We'd be in the top 10 if we were own country in terms of our agricultural output. So how do we begin to think about solving this problem? I ran for Soil and Water Commission in 2018, and I had a bunch of people tell me, no, you're not going to win. There's somebody else who's better known, and you're not from Iowa, and so on and so forth. And I said, well, okay, I'll still give it a shot. And I had a platform, and I harnessed the power of social media. You watch Donald Trump, whether you like him or not, but you got to respect the fact of how he has been able to harness social media. And I did that, and I won a spot. And it was interesting, both before and after the election, when I would introduce myself to people, more often than not, they would say, yeah, we know who you are.
From their social media?
We've read your materials. We like what you have to say, or occasionally they might have something that they didn't like, but that's okay, too. I want to hear. One of my principles is I want to hear what you think, how you think, why you come to your conclusions, and that will help me better understand your thinking. And we might learn something about each other. I might change some of my views, and we might actually come to some better conclusions.
And this is a Polk County position.
This is Polk County.
So how many on the commission?
There's five. There's five commissioners. There's 99 counties. There's actually 100 commissions. So I ask people this: if you know the one county that has two, you get a gold star.
Well, I'm going to take a guess. There's usually two. It's Pottawatomie has two fairs, but I don't know if they have two commissions.
Yes, you get it. I think you're probably the first, maybe the second person who's ever guessed that.
The only other guess would be Kossuth County because of its size.
Yes, that's
in
right.
Northeast double county. Central Iowa. Yeah, double county because so much water, not any inhabitable area. So Pottawatomie County.
Scott County might be a good county guess, too, because it's got two county seats. But
Scott County?
Is it Scott?
Well, Scott, no, down
is
the
it
river.
Henry?
No, it's Fort Madison and Keokuk, or...
Whatever the one
Lee
is.
Lee County.
Lee County, that's
Lee
what
County
I'm
thinking
Lee County
has two. Because
Lee County.
Yep, they have the two county seats. Because I remember I worked in Davenport for a number of years, and it was, go to the county seat.
Yeah.
Well, which one? Because, you know, that's how you had to learn about those things.
Right.
Water is a topic that when you put the stats out there, like you just said, about Iowa, any of the I states, the people that listen to this in any place of the country, water is a topic, whether it's for feeding the crops, for drinking, or for recreation. We all have uses for this resource.
Yep.
I mean, not like land where they're not making more of it. Water just comes from different sources, and maybe some's in the ground. Is water as big of a deal as I think it is?
Yeah. I think there are a couple of things that are fundamental to our agricultural system here in Iowa, and one is water. If we don't have water, we're not going to be producing very much for very long. And so the idea, I think, of water sovereignty is something we need to keep in mind, that there, as we just talked about earlier, California and the Southwest that relies on the Colorado, those are areas of the country that may be impacted by water availability. And they also have the struggle of the urban versus rural fight. That's part of what's happening in California and in the Southwest, is there's a fight over who gets the water, and over time it's typically the cities that went out. They get more of that surplus that then ag has to cut back. Here in Iowa, we have a sovereignty. You know, we need to pay attention to our water, and we need to water in soil actually is the other thing that I wanted to talk about with you, because the two are related actually here in Iowa. And one of the critical ideas is that soil health actually plays a tremendous, not not well understood role. I took my soils classes at Yale back in 1992. Fascinating. Went to Puerto Rico on a soils field trip of all places, and who would know that Puerto Rico's got 11 out of the 12 soil orders of the world. Very diverse island.
Didn't know that.
Yeah.
Thank you, John.
And so soil health is super critical, and one of the most important functions of our soil is the infield capacity of that soil, its ability to hold water. And I'll just give you one example. I was talking not too long ago with Wayne Fredericks, I'm sure, who's been on, if not on your show, is somebody that's on your radar screen. And so he's done some of the longest standing research on some of these impacts of soil health, and specifically soil organic matter and the role that plays, both in the carbon and the nitrogen cycling, but also in the ability to store of that soil to store water. So he said, John, I've learned that over time, a 1% increase in soil organic matter in my soils has delivered 27,000 gallons of additional storage that is in the field. And, you know, why is that important? Well, one of the reasons it's important is you can extend the evapotranspiration of the crops in the field by another 5 or 6 days. And if you add more soil organic matter and you get that level up another percent, then you can begin to extend that even further. And so in drought situations, that becomes important. Now, why does that matter, though, for downstream communities? And so I'll just throw out a couple of facts. So the 27,000 gallons, I had no idea. You know, what is that, a lot? Is that a little? It sounds like a lot, but I don't really know how much that is. And so I did some math. I said, let's think about what would that relate, how would that relate to somebody here in the metro, with something they could understand. And I said, well, Sailorville Lake, that's kind of a big body of water. And I wonder how much storage Sailorville Lake has. And I'm not talking about the normal pool that you drive your boat on in the summertime. I'm talking about the flood storage, you know, the capacity, that additional storage all the way up to the top of the spillway. And that's, I don't know, 641,000 acre feet. We measure big volumes of water in acre feet.
Correct.
And so, when you take that number, and you multiply it by 10 million acres, which is a big amount of land, and we grow 23 million acres, so 10 million, just rough math. Mm-hmm. How many Sailorville Lakes worth of storage do you think we're talking about?
This is where math and me don't get along. So we'll just say 4.
That's a good guess. That's a good guess. Most people don't guess that large. It's if I've done my math right, it's 1.3. And so that begins to give you, at flood storage, an idea of the ability of just that 1% increase in soil organic matter across 10 million acres.
All about keeping the water. You're talking about if I can keep the water locally.
Water in the field. That's
in the field.
First place we need to store it. Keep it in the field where it belongs, where it can be productive. Let's not send it down the river. Another little fact, I was curious, well, you know, how big is the watershed for the Des Moines and Raccoon River? You know, that's the confluence. That's where the original Fort Des Moines was. Mm-hmm. That sounds like a pretty cool place to maybe pay attention to. How big a watershed, if we drew a line around the watersheds that demarked the Raccoon and the Des Moines rivers, how much are we talking about? And I asked Chris Jones to help me sort of come
University
up with that
of
number.
Iowa.
Yeah, University of Iowa. And Chris came back, and I rounded up a little bit, but it's almost 10,000 square miles. 10,000 square miles, there's 640 acres to a square mile. So we're talking about maybe 6.4 million total acres. And so that 10 million, keep that in the back of your mind. Mm-hmm. Now, not all of the 6.4 is in agriculture, but a good chunk of that is. And of the 50 million hogs that we raise per year, probably, I don't know, 20% maybe is in that watershed too. So that begins to give you a sense of the potential of storing that water. Let's not send it down the rivers. Let's keep it close to the field first. That should be our first motto. And so what is the infrastructure then? What are the levers that we can begin to pull to begin to shape that vision? And certainly soil health is a big one, big part of it. So we need to align our policies and our practices to that concept, and that's starting to happen, which is good. Another part of this, it's really the three legs of the stool that I ran on, is the second leg has to do with what I call our ag plumbing. And so in the state of Iowa, 23 million acres, 14 million or so is tiled of the 23, mm-hmm. and then 6 or 7 of that is controlled by something called drainage districts. Drainage districts are some of our oldest state-chartered creatures, going back to almost to our state's founding. Our constitution talks, state constitution talks about drainage, actually. It's fascinating. Somebody said to me, oh, what the concept of watersheds is new, John. I said, no, the concept of watersheds goes back to the founding of the state. We just didn't call them watersheds. We call them drainage districts. We call them drainage areas.
Mm-hmm.
So the drainage districts, as the name implies, were for the most part, singular function. I mean, we wanted to drain the land to get to make the ag land productive. And so that was the focus. And that was continues to be an important focus. But we are now in a situation where we really need to think more about these drainage districts. The new vision I would throw out is, or put out there, is water management districts. And so we need to start thinking about what are all the different functions. Think about on a spectrum. Drainage is one part of the spectrum of water management. And then we have things like, you know, in certain cases, irrigation, mm-hmm. aquifer recharge, water filtration, and so on and so forth. And so these drainage districts are an opportunity for us to begin to think about how do we both maintain our productivity, but we add resiliency, the ability to adapt, and we keep in the back of our mind water sovereignty. You know, we may need every drop of water in the future. So let's first keep it in the field. If we can't keep it in the field, we're going to need to have some aspects of the water water management system that has to do with wetlands, mm-hmm. for example. And so we have 1,600 of those we've identified around the state as important, something called CREP wetlands.
I don't want to take you off your train, but you've left a couple of points for follow-up here. Let's start with the crop side.
Yeah.
Are we having to change our crops in Iowa?
Yeah. So the third leg of the stool, the 23 million acres of cropland, some of the most productive in the world, there's about 2.5 million of the 23 million acres that should not be, in my opinion, in corn and beans.
But there's a pushback on some of the marginal land that might be intended for reserve or wetland protection, that is acreage that might be lower in price, not as high of return, but an opportunity for someone to get involved in farming. And that's been one of the pushbacks.
Yeah. And I think it is important to keep people, get people involved in farming. But I have a different vision of how we do that. And so I think the 2.5 million acres that is not typically productive, if you look over averages of periods of time. So we've talked about the 400,000, Larry Weber and people have identified the 400,000 acres in the 2-year floodplain and so forth. And some of our highly erodible land that we converted to cropland with an impact on soil erosion and so forth. And so if we think about how do we realign some of our land uses, and we align the federal program dollars, particularly crop insurance, the number two entitlement behind nutrition, to support an idea of let's think about what the highest and best use for an area might be, and then let's align the public support mm-hmm. to support that use. If you want to go off and you do your 2-year floodplain and farm corn and beans, you know, good luck. Mm-hmm. Go do that. But maybe the public dollars should not be supporting that. The crop insurance should not be supporting that activity. Where do the new farmers go? Well, I think part of what we need to figure out is, you know, the corn and beans will always be an incredibly important, at least for the foreseeable future, part of Iowa agriculture. But if we, you know, think about 100 acres and 85 is in corn and beans or 90, the conversation should be, what do we do with the other 10 to 15 acres? And some of this, you know, just look around the world. I read the Wall Street Journal every day and see what's coming down the road. And so there's, you know, the higher value agriculture that we need to be thinking about. California is supplying 90% of fruits and vegetables. you know, is that going to continue? Perhaps, but I think there's going to be some opportunities here in places like Iowa if we can expand our mind, the transformational thinking about, you know, maybe everything isn't grown outdoors. If I go to Costco and I buy my hothouse tomatoes and I see the labels Canada or Denmark, why can't we do that mm-hmm. here in Iowa? Mm-hmm. And so I think the new farming in part has to be about, you know, the families that are generational and Mitchell Hora.
You mentioned Mitchell Hora,
right.
Past guest on this right. show. He's well known in a lot of circles for doing things, though, that are differently. He,
yes.
You and I were discussing before we even got yeah. started today about Mitchell, and he's someone that, like many new coming back yeah. to the farm or wanting to stay on the farm, he's yeah. had to find new ways
right.
to be involved because of the traditional
right.
way. It sounds like it's working for him. He's
right.
got a business that has allowed him to help other farmers, and it's about carbon. He's on
yeah.
the front end of
yep.
a number of things. Is it his type of thinking that's going to get us off of that treadmill of corn, beans,
yeah.
corn, beans, and that's all we do to think of? Let's
yeah.
go back to your analysis
yeah.
of we have 90 acres. What do we do with the
right.
other 10?
Yeah. Yeah, so I think you know, Mitchell's example is a good one in terms of how do we think differently and where can we add value to the equation, particularly from a systems perspective. And you know, some of the historical, again going back to history, some of the historical figures of people who have revolutionized agriculture, and I mean, I'll just mention two. John Deere, you mm-hmm. know, an interesting story in John Deere. And John Deere was not from the Midwest. John Deere was a blacksmith mm-hmm. from Middlebury, Vermont, mm-hmm. who created some technology that then revolutionized the agriculture here in the Midwest. And of course, now we're learning some new lessons. Another figure was George Washington Carver, a black man, mm-hmm. a son of a slave, from Missouri, who came up to Iowa, had some new ideas, and spent a semester at Simpson College mm-hmm. as an art student, and then eventually found his way to Iowa State. And I think of him in some ways as one of the original soil health pioneers, even though he's known for a lot of work in peanuts mm-hmm. in new markets. So these are people who think differently, and we need people like Mitchell and others who see new ways of doing things. The Wallaces are a great example of that too. And so some of that is required, but you know, there's also the need for new jobs if we can think creatively within the system. And so, for example, one of the things that principles of soil health that we need to follow along with, let's, you know, minimize disturbance to the soil, so we don't really need all this big machinery. We don't necessarily need all these inputs. There's a period of time of transition we need to pay attention to. Mm-hmm. But another critical relationship to that soil health is the relationship between the land, the soil, and the animals, livestock. And so we really need more livestock running around on the land. That's really important. But the question is, who's going to do it? And in Iowa, our land ownership now, the ag land ownership, is such that when we talk about farmers, I like to split and talk about them as farm operators. Those are the people actually driving the tractor. But in Iowa, 60% of the ag land ownership is not owned by the farmer driving the tractor. It's absentee owned.
Mm-hmm.
And so now you have a smaller subset of people. You've got the people who are the absentee landowners. Now, I like to talk about Martha, who's 94 and lives in Florida, and she owns 1,000 acres. Now, she's not going to be driving the tractor. She's not going to come to a field day.
Mm-hmm.
She might know something about soil health. Maybe if the operator has told her something about it, maybe not. The operator might not have the incentive. They might be about speed. And
Martha only might care if the check clears.
Yeah, Martha just cares about the check. And so if we want to then begin to get into soil health, we've educated Martha, we've educated her children. They say, hey, look, we really care about the longevity of the farm, and I want to pass this on to the next generation. And let's start thinking in multiple generations. Let's stop thinking like the Native Americans mm-hmm. think in terms of 6 or 7 generations. In fact, I'd like to think about 100 generations. And so we need more animals. Well, Martha's not going to do it. So who's going to do it? And how do we get the animals, if Martha's willing, on her 1,000 acres? So we start thinking about rotational grazing and building community markets for grazing. Mm-hmm. And how does that happen? Well, we're going to need people. We're going to need younger people to do that sort of thing.
But there's going to be a little pushback on the number of livestock, because there's groups out there, you mentioned methane, who think we have too many animals and we need to do away with eating meat.
Right.
Or at least reduce it.
Yeah.
You've had a USDA in the past that threw out the Meatless Monday, and it seemed like people became unnerved as a way to reduce greenhouse gases. But you're saying that an increase in livestock might actually help in all of this health.
Well, not
on the environmental
and
side.
And how that livestock operates. So I think there's a whole set of strategies and other requirements we need to pay attention to if we're talking about confinement operations of various sorts, where the animals are indoors and not running around. And then we're talking about grazing, where we actually have the animals out on the land. Mm-hmm. And they might be down in the field with the corn and beans and eating in that field, the cover crops or the forage that's left after the harvest. Mm-hmm. Or they might be up in the pasture, or both. There's going to need to be, for that balance of nature, in order to encourage and increase, regenerate the soil health, we need a better balance of animals and land. And so, we need to pay attention to how we do that in a way that can add value, both from a soil and an economic standpoint, because there's opportunities there to build outside of the commodity system. The commodity system is an important part, the base, if you will, of the economy, but we need to diversify and add to that base.
Let's go back to the point of drainage districts in some of these areas.
Right.
Are we plugging the tile? Are we keeping the land farmable? I mean, are we trying to keep the water?
Yeah.
I mean, that's why we had the tile.
Yeah.
So how do we address that?
Yeah, well, there's a relationship between the tile and productivity and soil health. And one of the things you have to understand is that because of the way that we've farmed, particularly after World War II, and the inputs that we've used and so forth, we've depleted the soil organic matter from an historic rate where it was, I don't know, between 4%, 5%, 6%, maybe even higher in some places, down to 2% and so forth. And so that soil behaves very differently now than it did when it was, when you had the biology that was in balance. And so one of the factors for that now is that the water, the hydrology of that system behaves differently. The runoff, for example, if you have more frequent storm events of intensity, the soil, the degraded soil is less likely to be able to infiltrate that water. And so you'll see that runoff. The tiling has been designed in some cases for the depleted soils. You know, the soil gets more depleted, and so we put in more tiling. We have more extreme weather.
I can't get on there in April when I need to. Let's put in another couple of lines.
Yeah, and that'll be the solution. And that's one approach. But the other approach is to pay attention to the soil health. And some of the stories, the evidence now is building that if you have good soil health, the way the tiling reacts and the amount of tiling may be different. And the other thing to think about, too, if we start thinking about water management and the idea that we want to keep as much of this water available and for use as possible, and we talk about the infield storage, so we're going to store more in the field. And the solutions maybe when the engineers, I think, or the people that were designing these systems originally, the goal often was get the water off the field, get it into the ditch, get into the river, get rid of it. I want to as quickly as possible. And now the design solution may be get it off the field where we want to grow things, but put it into this area over here, this wetland or this recharge area, where it can be useful. And so the design solution may be different. We might have more distributed storage within some of these drainage districts. And I've saw some of that happen firsthand. Some of the upstream county supervisors invited me. They said, John, you ask a lot of questions. Why don't you come up and see one of these drainage district hearings? And I learned a heck of a lot from witnessing that that hearing and the idea of water moving across through a drainage district. Sometimes you have multiple drainage districts involved, and when you add a wetland, for example, that may change the opportunities in the flow of that drainage water. Instead of going directly to the ditch and the stream and into the river and causing the problems, it goes some other place first, or it stays there. Mm-hmm.
I know in flood control, the discussion was always the longer you can delay the water,
yes.
the better off we
yeah.
can withstand these
right.
events of
yeah.
4 inches, 8 inches,
right.
10 inches of rain
yeah.
on an overnight.
Yeah.
And that sounds like what you're saying is agreeing with that
yeah.
statement there a little bit. All right.
Yeah.
I need to
yeah.
tie some things together
yes,
here as
please
we
do.
Close. But I'm going to go back to your home, where you lived, and
yes.
where you're at now.
I like that.
Rural versus urban means
yeah.
different things in different places. I
yeah.
asked in Boston, who
yeah.
was more of the issue? Was it the farmers of
yeah.
the rural areas that contributed to Boston Harbor? In
yeah.
California, the rural needs to keep the water. In Iowa, there's this discussion of rural wants to get rid of the water, and the urban, and both rural and urban are contributing to its demise. Hmm. Is there any commonality other than the word water
yeah.
in any of those scenarios
yeah.
or stories?
Yeah. Well, I think of rural and urban as yin and yang, you know, the Chinese symbol of balance. And so these two need to be in balance. And we too often, you know, we want to sort of draw a line in the sand and say it's us versus them, it's mm-hmm. rural versus urban. You know, if we looked at some of the land ownership, I think, and traced it back, we would be surprised how many people here in Des Moines have a land ownership interest up in some of the rural areas,
especially in the areas that were under the lawsuit that
right.
Didn't
yeah.
come.
So we're talking
all the way
about
through.
Some of the same people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the idea is it's in our collective interest as a state. The agriculture is a foundation of our economy. And, you know, we have some flashing signals. We got 70 counties that are, I think it's 70 that are in population decline and 10 that are flatlined. And that in part is because we don't have a agricultural system that is resilient and diversified and adaptive. And so if we want people to live in the rural areas, then we got to create new opportunities for them. So I do think that there's relationship there. And then on the urban side, we have urban, we need our drinking water. That's foundational. That's a rural mm-hmm. and a urban issue. We want clean, healthy drinking water wherever you live. And in the urban areas, we get the water delivered from upstream. We want to be able to recreate and use water for its other uses. That's important. We have the flood issues that has an economic impact. And so I see Iowa, my vision for Iowa is to build this agricultural system and shift some of the focus away from just sheer production, productivity as measured in yield, top line yield, to profitability and resiliency, so that as these weather extremes start happening more frequently, we have a system that's built to be resilient mm-hmm. and flexible and adaptive. And I think we can do that.
If I take my 100 acres and put 10 into something else, how am I going to make money? I need all 100
yeah.
acres. I've had to, as Earl Butt said,
yeah.
fence row to fence row
yeah.
plant to make
yeah.
the to pay my bank
yeah.
note
right.
in operations. So how do you encourage someone
yeah.
to take something out of
yeah.
production that's going to make money? And,
yeah.
and I know the answer easily could say, well, how could you afford not to, Mr.
Yeah.
Yeager, when you're
yeah.
trying to buy the vacuum?
Yeah.
I mean, but there's some truth to that.
Yeah.
How do you decide who
yeah.
pays for something? At some point, somebody's got to
yeah.
pay for
yeah.
something.
So let's go back to the example of the 2.5 million acres that could be doing something else. And so, for example, the crop insurance in the public side, I think it's 40% typically. And instead of spending those dollars to grow corn and beans on that, let's say that acreage that's either highly erodible or 2-year flood plan, we say, look, that from a public perspective, that land would be better off in CRP
mm-hmm.
or some sort of a cattle pasture ground. And so we have our program set up for that. We have CRP that's targeted CRP. This is one of the things that we learned with our Polk County.
Not just open enrolled CRP.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of first in line.
Okay.
You know, get in line, first in line. And
okay.
there's probably a role for that. But we need to be much more targeted because, like any business, we have limited resources. So you have to look at where you're going to get the maximum bang on the buck. And so for the landowner perspective, and I'll tell you a story. I was at a cover crop field day we sponsored, and a woman who is in her mid-60s, I was sitting with her at lunch and asking her questions, and, oh, I've got a family farm, and we grow corn and beans. And she says, but I'm taking it all out of corn and beans. I'm going to put it in CRP. And I said, oh, that's interesting. Why are you doing that? And she said, well, I ran the numbers and discovered I can make as much money running CRP. And my brother was the one farming the land. And frankly, that was a lot of hassle and, you know, stress and so forth. And so that's sort of an extreme result. But I think the idea that a portion of the farm, as you suggested, look at that highest and best use. And if the highest and best use is, for example, CRP, it's almost like, you know, I put on my financial portfolio hat and you think about stocks and bonds. In the CRP ground, it's a predictable payment, right, payment stream. That behaves much more like a bond. And from a financial perspective in corn, you know, corn goes up and down. It's over $5 now. People, it's great times. But that goes up and down depending on what's happening in the world economy from year to year. And so that's a way to begin to think about, from a portfolio perspective, how does the farmland earn a return? The working land. And so there may be different uses of the land that earn a financial return. We've sort of forgotten some of this because we've gotten so used to growing corn and beans. It's so easy to do, and all the support payments that support that system. It makes us, you know, we have to rediscover some of the advantages of thinking about a landscape that's more diverse.
All right, we're going to pause. We're going to go now for hour 4 and 5 in this discussion, John. But it'd easily be done if we keep going.
Yeah, it's a fun subject.
All right, that's John Norwood. Thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it. And like I said, we could keep going, and maybe we'll just have to have you back.
I appreciate that, Paul.
And keep discussing this topic that does impact us from coast to coast. Thank you, John.
Thank you for the opportunity.
My thanks to John Norwood. If you have other feedback and you don't want to send it to me, send it to markettomarket@iowapbs.org. Thank you, John. Thank you for watching, listening, or reading. We'll see you next time.